Chapter 2 Severian. Memory oppresses me. Having been reared among the torturers, I have never known my father or my mother, nor did my brother apprentices know theirs. From time to time, but most particularly when winter draws on, poor wretches come clamoring to the corpse door, hoping to be admitted to our ancient guild. Often they regale Brother Porter with accounts of the torments they will willingly inflict in payment for warmth and food. Occasionally they fetch animals as samples of their work. All are turned away. Traditions from our days of glory, antedating the present degenerate age and the one before it, and the one before that, an age whose name is hardly remembered now by scholars, forbid recruitment from such as they. Even at the time I write of, when the guild had shrunk to 2 masters and less than a score of journeymen, those traditions were honored. From my earliest memory, I remember all. That first recollection is of piling pebbles in the old yard. It lies south and west of the Witch's Keep, and is separated from the Grand Court. The curtain wall our guild was to help defend was ruinous even then, with a wide gap between the Red Tower and the Bear, where I used to climb the fallen slabs of unsmeltable gray metal to look out over the necropolis that descends that side of Citadel Hill. When I was older, it became my playground. The winding paths were patrolled during daylight hours, but the sentries were largely concerned for the fresher graves on the lower ground, and knowing us to belong to the torturers, they seldom had much stomach for expelling us from our lurking places in the cypress groves. Our necropolis is said to be the oldest in Nessus. That is certainly false, but the very existence of the error testifies to a real antiquity. Though the autarchs were not buried there, even when the citadel was their stronghold, and the great families, then as now, preferred to inter their long-limbed dead in vaults on their own estates. But the armigers and optimates of the city favored the highest slopes, near the citadel wall, and the poorer commons lay below them until the farthest reaches of the bottom lands, pressing against the tenements that came to line Guile, held potter's fields. As a boy, I seldom went so far alone, or half so far. There were always the three of us, Draught, Roche, and I. Later, Ita, the next oldest among the apprentices. None of us were born among the torturers, for none are. It is said that in ancient times there were both men and women in the guild, and that sons and daughters were born to them and brought up in the mystery, as is now the case among the lampmakers and the goldsmiths and many other guilds. But Emar the Almost Just, observing how cruel the women were, and how often they exceeded the punishments he had decreed, ordered that there should be women among the torturers no more. Since that time, our numbers have been repaired solely from the children of those who fall into our hands. In our Matachin Tower, a certain bar of iron thrusts from a bulkhead at the height of a man's groin. Male children, small enough to stand upright beneath it, are nurtured as our own, and when a woman big with child is sent to us, we open her, and if the babe draws breath, engage a wet nurse if it be a boy. The females are rendered to the witches. So it has been since the days of Emar, and those days are now by many hundreds of years forgotten. Thus none of us knows our descent. Each would be an exultant if he could, and it is a fact that many persons of high lineage are given over to us. As boys, each of us formed his own conjectures, and each attempted to question the older brothers among the journeymen, though they were locked in their own bitterness and told us little. Ita, believing himself descended of that family, drew the arms of one of the great northern clans on the ceiling above his cot in the year of which I speak. For my part, I had already adopted as my own the devices graved in bronze above the door of a certain mausoleum. They were a fountain rising above waters, and a ship volant, and below these a rose. The door itself had been sprung long ago. Two empty coffins lay on the floor. Three more, too heavy for me to shift and still intact, waited on the shelves along one wall. Neither the closed coffins nor the open ones constituted the attraction of the place, though I sometimes rested on what remained of the soft, faded padding of the latter. Rather, it was the smallness of the room, the thick walls of masonry, and the single, narrow window with its one bar, together with the faithless door, so massively heavy, that remained eternally ajar. Through window and door, I could look out unseen on all the bright life of tree and shrub and grass outside. The linnets and rabbits that fled when I approached could neither hear nor scent me there. I watched the storm crow build her nest and rear her young, 2 cubits from my face. I saw the fox trot by with upraised brush, and once that giant fox, taller than all but the tallest hounds that men call the maned wolf, loped by at dusk on some unguessable errand from the ruined quarters of the south. The Karakara coursed vipers for me, and the hawk lifted his wings to the wind from the top of a pine. A moment suffices to describe these things, for which I watched so long. The decades of Asaros would not be long enough for me to write all they meant to the ragged apprentice boy I was. Two thoughts that were nearly dreams obsessed me and made them infinitely precious. The first was that at some not distant time, time itself would stop. The colored days that had so long been drawn forth like a chain of conjurer's scarves come to an end. The sullen sun wink out at last. The second was that there existed somewhere a miraculous light, which I sometimes conceived of as a candle, sometimes as a flambeau, that engendered life in whatever objects it fell upon, so that a leaf plucked from a bush grew slender legs and waving feelers, and a rough brown brush opened black eyes and scurried up a tree. Yet sometimes, particularly in the sleepy hours around noon, there was little to watch. Then I turned again to the blazon over the door and wondered what a ship, a rose, and a fountain had to do with me, and stared at the funeral bronze I had found and cleaned and set up in a corner. The dead man lay at full length, his heavy-lidded eyes closed. In the light that pierced the little window, I examined his face and meditated on my own as I saw it in the polished metal. My straight nose, deep-set eyes, and sunken cheeks were much like his, and I longed to know if he too had dark hair. In the winter, I seldom came to the necropolis, but in summer, that violated mausoleum and others, provided me with places of observation and cool repose. Draught and Rosh and Eta came too, though I never guided them to my favorite retreat, and they, I knew, had secret places of their own. When we were together, we seldom crept into tombs at all. Instead, we made swords of sticks and held running battles, or threw pine cones at the soldiers, or scratched boards on the soil of new graves, and played draughts with stones, and ropes and snails and high-toss cockle. We amused ourselves in the maze that was the citadel, too, and swam in the great cistern under the bellkeep. It was cold and damp there, even in summer, under its vaulted ceiling, beside the circular pool of endlessly deep, dark water. But it was hardly worse in winter, and it had the supreme advantage of being forbidden, so we could slip down to it with delicious stealth when we were assumed to be elsewhere, and not kindle our torches until we had closed the barred hatch behind us. Then, when the flames shot up from the burning pitch, how our shadows danced up those clammy walls. As I have already mentioned, our other swimming place was in Gaiol, which winds through Nessus like a great weary snake. When warm weather came, we trooped through the necropolis on our way there. First past the old, exalted sepulchres nearest the citadel wall, then between the vainglorious death houses of the Optimates, then through the stony forest of common monuments, we trying to appear highly respectable when we had to pass the burly guards leaning on their pole arms, and at last across the plain bare mounds that marked the interments of the poor, mounds that sank to puddles after the first rain. At the lowest margin of the necropolis stood the iron gate I have already described. Through it, the bodies intended for the potter's field were borne. When we passed those rusting portals, we felt we were for the first time truly outside the citadel, and thus in undeniable disobedience of the rules that were supposed to govern our comings and goings. We believed, or pretended to believe, we would be tortured if our older brothers discovered the violation. In actuality, we would have suffered nothing worse than a beating. Such is the kindness of the torturers, whom I was subsequently to betray. We were in greater danger from the inhabitants of the many-storied tenements that lined the filthy street down which we walked. I sometimes think the reason the guild has endured so long is that it serves as a focus for the hatred of the people, drawing it from the autarch, the exultants, and the army, and even in some degree from the pale Cacogens who sometimes visit Earth from the farther stars. The same presentiment that told the guards our identity often seemed to inform the residents of the tenements. Slops were thrown at us from upper windows occasionally, and an angry mutter followed us. But the fear that engendered this hatred also protected us. No real violence was done to us, and once or twice, when it was known that some tyrannical Wildgrave or venal Burgess had been delivered to the mercy of the guild, we received shouted suggestions as to his disposal, most of them obscene and many impossible. At the place where we swam, Gaiol had lost its natural banks hundreds of years ago. Here it was a two-chain-wide expanse of blue nenuphars penned between walls of stone. Steps intended for boat landings led down into the river at several points. On a warm day, each flight would be held by a gang of 10 or 15 brawling youths. The four of us lacked the strength to displace these groups, but they could not, or at least would not, deny us admission, though whichever we chose to join would threaten us as we approached and taunt us when we were in their midst. Soon, however, all would drift away, leaving us in sole possession until the next swimming day. I have chosen to describe all this now because I never went again after the day on which I saved Vodalus. Drotan Rosh believed it was because I was afraid we would be locked out. Eta guessed, I think. Before they come too near to being men, boys often have an almost female insight. It was because of the nenuphars. The necropolis has never seemed a city of death to me. I know its purple roses, which other people think so hideous, shelter hundreds of small animals and birds. The executions I have seen performed and have performed myself so often are no more than a trade. A butchery of human beings who are for the most part less innocent and less valuable than cattle. When I think of my own death, or of the death of someone who has been kind to me, or even of the death of the son, the image that comes to my mind is that of the nenuphar, with its glossy pale leaves and azure flower. Under flower and leaves are black roots as fine and strong as hair, reaching down into the dark waters. As young men, we thought nothing of these plants. We splashed and floated among them, pushed them aside, and ignored them. Their perfume countered, to some degree, the foul odor of the water. On the day I was to save Otolus, I dove beneath their crowded pads, as I had done 1,000 times. I did not come up. Somehow, I had entered a region where the roots seemed far thicker than I had ever encountered them before. I was caught in 100 nets at once. My eyes were open, but I could see nothing, only the black web of the roots. I swam and could feel that though my arms and legs moved among their millions of fine tendrils, my body did not. I grasped them by the handful and tore them apart, but when I had torn them, I was immobilized as ever. My lungs seemed to rise in my throat to choke me, as if they would burst of themselves out into the water. The desire to draw breath, to suck in the dark, cold fluid around me, was overwhelming. I no longer knew in what direction the surface lay, and I was no longer conscious of the water as water. The strength had left my limbs. I was no longer afraid, though I knew I was dying, or perhaps already dead. There was a loud and very unpleasant ringing in my ears, and I began to see visions. Master Malrubius, who had died several years before, was waking us by drumming on the bulkhead with a spoon. That was the metallic din I heard. I lay in my cot, unable to rise, though Draughton Rosh and the younger boys were all up, yawning and fumbling for their clothes. Master Malrubius's cloak was thrown back. I could see the loose skin of his chest and belly, where the muscle and fat had been destroyed by time. There was a triangle of hair there, and it was as gray as mildew. I tried to call to him to tell him I was awake, but I could make no sound. He began to walk along the bulkhead, still striking it with his spoon. After what seemed a very long time, he reached the port, stopped and leaned out. I knew he was looking for me in the old yard below. Yet he could not see far enough. I was in one of the cells below the examination room. I lay there on my back, looking up at the gray ceiling. A woman cried, but I could not see her, and I was less conscious of her sobs than of the ringing, ringing, ringing of the spoon. Darkness closed over me. But out of the darkness came the face of a woman, as immense as the green face of the moon. It was not she who wept. I could hear the sob still, and this face was untroubled, and indeed filled with that kind of beauty that hardly admits of expression. Her hands reached toward me, and I at once became a fledgling I had taken from its nest the year before in the hope of taming it to perch on my finger. For her hands were each as long as the coffins in which I sometimes rested in my secret mausoleum. They grasped me, pulled me up, then flung me down, away from her face and from the sound of sobbing, down into the blackness, until at last I struck what I took to be the bottom mud and burst through it into a world of light rimmed with black. Still, I could not breathe. I no longer wished to. And my chest no longer moved of itself. I was sliding through the water, though I did not know how. Later I learned that draught had seized me by the hair. At once I lay on the cold, slimy stones with Rosh, then draught, then Rosh again, breathing into my mouth. I was enveloped in eyes, as one is enveloped in the repetitious patterns of a kaleidoscope, and thought that some defect in my own vision was multiplying Ida's eyes. At last I pulled away from Rosh and vomited great quantities of black water. After that I was better. I could sit up and breathe again in a crippled way, and though I had no strength and my hands shook, I could move my arms. The eyes around me belonged to real people, the denizens of the riverside tenements. A woman brought a bowl of some hot drink. I could not be sure if it was soup or tea, only that it was scalding and somewhat salty and smelled of smoke. I pretended to drink it, and afterward found that I had slight burns on my lips and tongue. "Were you trying to do that?" Draught asked. "How did you come up?" I shook my head. Someone in the crowd said, "He shot right out of the water." Rosh helped me steady my hand. "We thought you'd come up somewhere else, that you were playing a joke on us." I said, "I saw Malrubius." An old man, a boatman from his tar-stained clothes, took Rosh by the shoulder. "Who's that?"
"Used to be master of apprentices. He's dead."
"Not a woman?"
The old man was holding Rosh but looking at me. "No, no," Rosh told him. "There are no women in our guild."
Despite the hot drink and the warmth of the day, I was cold. One of the youths we sometimes fought brought a dusty blanket, and I wrapped myself in it. But it was so long before I was strong enough to walk again that by the time we reached the gate of the necropolis, the statue of Night atop the khan on the opposite bank was a minute scratch of black against the sun's field of flame, and the gate itself stood closed and locked.